content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the June 2018 issue of Discover features four stories on climate change, trust, quasars, and sand. Should we cool Earth? Amid climate inaction, scientists confront an idea that scares them. Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines in 1991, spewing millions of tons of ash and chemicals into the atmosphere. Over the next year, large parts of Earth cooled by almost a full degree Fahrenheit. Volcanoes historically have caused some of the planet's sharpest temperature drops. In addition to ash and fire, they belch sulfur dioxide that lingers as a fine particle spray called an aerosol. These aerosols help Earth's atmosphere reflect incoming light, creating a cooling effect. Some scientists speculate that seeding such sulfur aerosols, absent fiery eruptions, could someday be a Hail Mary to counteract climate change. The idea is called geoengineering. Picture fleets of aircraft ferrying sulfur across the stratosphere year-round. University of Exeter climatologist Anthony Jones says developing aerosol-releasing technology might take a few years, and likely won't happen for decades, but it is possible. Cost estimates range from around $1 billion to $10 billion per year. That's less than current spending on climate research and mitigation, and far cheaper than coping with its consequences. Sulfur is even easy to get. It's a byproduct of fossil fuel production, so abundant that a mining outfit in Alberta, Canada, is stacking the stuff into a sulfur pyramid that could eventually dwarf Egypt's. The problem? We don't fully understand the consequences of geoengineering. Few real-world tests have taken place, and that's driving a surge of new research. Later this year, a Harvard University team hopes to gather some of the first real-world data in the Stratospheric Controlled Perturbation Experiment, SCOPEX. The researchers will send a balloon into the stratosphere above Tucson, Arizona, to spray particles across an area roughly a half mile long and a football field wide. A sensor-studded gondola will dip back through the cloud to measure how aerosol particles interact with one another and the atmosphere. If geoengineering is really going to be used in this sort of emergency climate catastrophe scenario, then you're not going to have that chance to learn about things going into it, says climate scientist Ken Caldera of the Carnegie Institute for Science. You pretty damn well better do the research up front. So far, computer climate models simulating solar geoengineering have predicted significant reductions in global warming, Caldera says. Yet researchers are hardly optimistic. If you ask me today to vote on whether we should geoengineer or never ever do it, I would be on the never ever side, says Gernot Wagner, executive director of Harvard's Solar Geoengineering Research Program. Many climate scientists agree. One reason is that aerosols aren't the opposite of carbon dioxide, says Peter Irvin, a Harvard expert in climate models. Aerosols counteract some symptoms of excess greenhouse gases, but not others, like ocean acidification. And sulfur depletes Earth's ozone layer. It's also a long-term commitment. Stop pumping out aerosols, and the climate would snap back. In fact, a January study in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution showed sporadic geoengineering could be more dangerous for animals adapting to climate change than never attempting it at all. Aerosols also reflect sunlight, instead of trapping heat like CO2. So they'd overcool the tropics and undercool the poles, creating unpredictable results. All this makes researchers worry about a rogue nation altering climate without considering global impacts. In Nature Communications last fall, Jones's team studied the impacts of releasing aerosols in one hemisphere. In short, it would be bad. Releasing aerosols in the northern hemisphere could suppress tropical cyclones. Doing the same thing in the southern hemisphere would increase their frequency in the north. And both would shift monsoons critical to tropical agriculture. But if the world ramped up aerosols in a measured way, say 1% of Pinatubo's sulfur emissions this year, 2% the next, and so on, that might slowly and smoothly even out the rise in temperatures, Caldera thinks. That still leaves a more human concern, though. In behavioral economics, it's called a moral hazard. When humans feel protected, we're more likely to take risks, like driving recklessly after putting on a seatbelt. If we see scientists trying to save us, we may stop worrying about greenhouse gases. And geoengineering isn't a real fix. Sulfur only covers up climate change. That leaves many climate scientists concerned about overselling geoengineering's potential. Researchers on Harvard's Scopex team even declined interviews for this piece, saying their project gets too much hype. Will somebody somewhere try things? That's a yes, within 50 or 100 years, Wagner says. Will it happen as part of a semi-rational climate policy globally coordinated? That's a bigger question. The power of three. How third parties can keep everyone honest. Back in 2008, on a trip to Russia, I got lost. My husband was working at his employer's Moscow office, and I had gotten off at the wrong bus stop on my way to meet him. With no way to tell him I'd be late, I thought I'd take a taxi. But there were no yellow cabs in sight, and back then, Uber was still just a German word. Hailing one of the city's gypsy cabs, unmarked, unlicensed cars, often driven by people unassociated with any company, seemed like my best bet. Still, I was wary of hitching a ride with a random stranger. As I spotted another pedestrian with his arm outstretched for passing cars, I had an idea. Maybe I'd be safer getting into a total stranger's car if this other stranger got in with me. Sure enough, I arrived on time and unscathed, and my fellow passenger wouldn't take a ruble from me to split the fare. I've thought of this incident many times in the years since, especially while working on a book about middlemen. Many of us see third parties as extraneous. We're often eager to cut them out, assuming trade would be quicker and cheaper without an intermediary. That was the promise with the Internet, whose connections would, it seemed, enable everyone to communicate and do business directly. But that didn't really pan out. In fact, middlemen businesses like Amazon, Airbnb, and Uber wouldn't even exist without the Internet. And there's a large body of research pointing to a key role that middlemen platforms like these play, keeping both sides honest. When people talk about these companies, like Uber and Airbnb, they talk about peer-to-peer, or sharing economy, as if it's just putting two people together and making them interact, says Bruno Abrahau, a computer scientist at New York University who has studied how people make decisions on Airbnb. But the platforms do much more, enabling strangers to trust each other. Abrahau points out, otherwise, you could just go to Craigslist. Social scientists have long known that without information about who's trustworthy, people tend to favor those who seem similar to them, and this can lead to discrimination. Researchers also have found that having a solid reputation instills a certain degree of trust. But to what degree did someone need a stellar reputation to prevent discrimination? Airbnb and Abrahau's team of sociologists and data scientists wanted to answer that question. The researchers conducted an experiment on nearly 9,000 volunteer Airbnb users, forcing them to choose between trusting someone completely similar, for example, another middle-aged woman, and trusting someone different but with a better reputation than anyone else. In the study, published in 2017 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Aberhaus' team showed, among other findings, that seeing even one positive review, compared with none, was enough to offset people's natural instincts to trust other people similar to them. That finding explains much of the early success of eBay, the auction website's feedback system, which lets buyers and sellers rate each other, eased the way for people to send money and goods to strangers from all over the world. Similarly, whenever I step in a rideshare today, I trust the driver to give me a safe ride, even if the driver's in-app photo makes him look sketchy. Even when third parties don't track reputations, they can still create accountability. That's because these people often have reputations of their own, already known to others to punish wrongdoing. Diego Gambetta, a sociologist at Nuffield College, Oxford, has studied how the Sicilian Mafia helps guarantee contracts when a weak government fails to do so. In his classic 1993 book about this research, he summed up the role by quoting a cattle rancher who does occasional business with a butcher. "When the butcher comes to me to buy an animal, he knows that I want to cheat him," the rancher explained. "But I know that he wants to cheat me." With such mutual distrust, it seems there'd be no deal at all. So the two men turn to a third, a mafioso named Pepe. "We need Pepe to make us agree, and we both pay Pepe a percentage of the deal." How does this tie into my ride in Moscow? Sure, the unlicensed cabbies were unregulated, but it's not as if my fellow passenger was a known tough guy. Yet having a third party around, even one without a reputation, can affect behavior for the better. Consider the so-called trust game, which social scientists often use in the lab. Usually there are two players, and the first player can send money to the second. And the more trust there is between the players, the more money they can get. For example, if I send you $2, the game will triple that to $6. Now you have $6 and I have nothing. But if you send $3 of that back to me, we'll each have more than we started with. So, the more I send you, the more I stand to gain by trusting you to send me money back. But you can abuse my trust by keeping more than your share. Fewer people take advantage of the first player when the experiment introduces a third player who watches over the other two, according to a 2017 paper that examined the effects of adding a third player to the trust game. As individuals, we want to be good, to do what's right, but we also have to take care of ourselves, explains Ernan Haruvi, an economist at the University of Texas at Dallas, who co-authored the paper. A third party helps resolve that conflict. Does Haruvi's logic explain why I felt safer in Moscow, sharing a car with two strangers rather than just one? Yes and no. Although I wasn't thinking the driver would want to make a good impression, I did believe a potential criminal wouldn't want witnesses. Scientists have hypothesized that people's concerns with their public image run so deep, even hints of oversight might elicit good behavior. A 2007 experiment had the image of a big-eyed robot named Kismet watch participants playing a game in which they could contribute resources to a common pool. A control group played the same game without Kismet. The Kismet group contributed 29% more. Since then, other studies seem to have found similar effects. But Stephanie Northover, a psychology doctoral student at Arizona State University, recently conducted two reviews of such research and is skeptical. In each study she scrutinized, hints of artificial supervision only occasionally elicited good behavior. For example, in some studies, watchful eyes worked on men, not women. Other studies found they improved behavior only when very few people were around. In other words, don't count on supposed surveillance to protect you. Human oversight is better, though we can't rely on the kindness of strangers. Some will give you a free ride, some will charge you for a ride, and others might take you for a ride. But as my Moscow experience reminds me, two strangers are usually better than one. as the mighty quasars flow. Are billions of black holes behind some of the universe's mysterious energy signals? Gaze up at the sky on a clear night, far from the city lights, and you might see the moon and some stars, a few planets, and maybe even the fuzzy glow of the Milky Way. In between, there seems to be nothing but emptiness and darkness, says Zaiwei Wang, an astronomy graduate student at Harvard University. At least, that was our view of the cosmos until 50 or so years ago, when astronomers realized that space was not as empty as we once thought. In 1964, astronomers were surprised to discover a uniform sea of radiation coming from all directions, all the time. Later, dubbed the Cosmic Microwave Background, CMB, this low-energy light turned out to be the residual radiation from the Big Bang itself, cooled during its journey over the past 13.8 billion years. Studying the CMB has led to tremendous insights about the structure and composition of our universe, its exact age, and even its shape. In the decades since, astronomers have learned there's much more to the unseen universe, finding background radiation at practically every wavelength observed. The highest frequency and most energetic background signals they've found are made up of a form of light called gamma rays, plus exotic particles called neutrinos and cosmic rays. And unlike the CMB, the source of these emissions is still enigmatic. No one knows where they come from. In three recent papers, Wang and her advisor, Harvard astronomer A.V. Loeb, advanced a new idea that suggests not one source for this high-energy background, but literally billions. It all comes down to a phenomenon called quasar outflows. Quasars are among the most luminous objects in the universe. Each one greatly outshines the combined output of all the stars in their host galaxies. For instance, in 2015, astronomers announced they'd found a quasar that shines some 400 trillion times brighter than our Sun. All large galaxies have giant black holes at their centers, and a quasar forms when one actively starts feeding, pulling in matter like gas and dust. But this stuff doesn't fall directly into the black hole. It circles around the abyss at ever-increasing speeds while spiraling inward. Eventually, the cosmic food becomes so hot from friction that it pours out light before some of it makes its way into the black hole. The object that generates this prodigious amount of light, the black hole and cloud of debris swirling around it, is a quasar. But a black hole doesn't eat everything in sight. Its mouth is simply not big enough. Some of the surrounding material gets ejected in different ways. 10% of known quasars shoot out matter at more than 99% of the speed of light through a pair of spectacular jets. Astronomers seeking a source for that exotic high-energy radiation took a close look at these powerful jets, but observations showed they weren't enough. All the universe's quasar jets could account for only about half the gamma rays and none of the neutrinos and cosmic rays. The unexplained emissions, according to Wang and Loeb, may stem from a more subtle feature of every quasar. They are milder but steadier outflows. What a black hole doesn't eat or shoot away in jets, it flings off at relatively moderate speeds, a few thousand miles per second, or about 1% the speed of light. After interacting with the local gas, these outflows can ultimately produce small amounts of all three components of the high-energy background, gamma rays, neutrinos, and cosmic rays. Individual outflows don't release enough energy for us to notice, which is why no one really considered them before. But a big enough number of them would add up. And in Wang and Loeb's scenario, the process is taking place at every quasar in the universe. A little energy times a lot of sources could, in theory, produce all that mysterious energy. Wang and Loeb set out to see if the numbers backed up their premise. In 2015, they started by focusing on gamma rays. Step one was trying to determine the tiny amount coming from each source. It wasn't easy. They had to approach the problem theoretically, because the emissions from an individual quasar are actually too weak for direct measurements. Drawing upon emissions in other wavelengths that they could observe for guidance, Wang and Loeb eventually came up with an estimate. The next step was to factor in contributions from the billions of quasars in our universe to figure out the total gamma-ray signal from all quasar outflows. This calculation was also complex, incorporating estimates of the total number of quasars, their general distribution in the sky, and the range in observed brightness. Brighter quasars emit more gamma rays. In the end, the total value Wang and Loeb arrived at, miraculously, was about half the gamma-ray background signal, perhaps comprising the missing half quasar jets could not explain. Encouraged, they repeated this exercise in late 2016 and early 2017 for neutrinos, and then cosmic rays. In both cases, their tallied sums closely matched experimentally obtained values for the neutrino and cosmic ray backgrounds. The numbers could work, suggesting they might have found the answer to the high-energy background problem. Unfortunately, the idea remains hypothetical until astronomers can get direct measurements of all three forms of radiation coming from a single quasar outflow. Luckily, more sensitive instruments for detecting gamma rays, neutrinos, and cosmic rays are in the works. If their quasar outflow idea is ultimately confirmed, it would do more than just clarify a long-standing astronomical puzzle. It would be another step toward answering the question of what's out there in the universe and where it comes from, says Wang. Sometimes the answers to the biggest questions in science lie in small and subtle things. These less visible entities are often neglected, but in the aggregate, they can be brighter and more powerful. She compares the situation to a piano concerto. The piano is loud enough to drown out any of the dozens of individual string instruments in a full orchestra, but when you put all the strings together, their contribution is substantial. In the same way, the cumulative output of quasar outflows could make a difference on a cosmic scale. So the next time you look at the night sky, remember that what we see with the naked eye is a tiny, tiny fraction of the things happening in the cosmos, says Wang. Appreciating the piano concerto of the universe involves learning to hear all the instruments, no matter how faint and unimportant they might seem. 20 Things You Didn't Know About Sand. 1. Got sand? You probably do, in your kitchen pantry. Sand is defined as any material made up of grains within a specific size range. Sugar and salt typically qualify. 2. Much less common, however, is gypsum sand, which gives White Sands National Monument in New Mexico its name. The site's unusually high concentration of the rare variety started out as a shallow seabed about 280 million years ago. 3. The material most commonly thought of as sand is silica, made of quartz crystals that have broken down about as far as they will naturally, to about a millimeter in diameter. 4. At the beach, silica sand mixes with fragments of coral, shell, and other material of biological origin. 5. While sand of all sorts is usually made by material breaking down into smaller pieces, in water with high concentrations of calcium carbonate or certain other minerals, the opposite can happen. A tiny particle gets coated over time by the minerals, resulting in a special type of sand grain called an oolith. 6. Members of Palaeothoa, a genus of coral, can be up to 65% sand by weight. They use the material to build their frame, making them more resistant to climate change effects such as ocean acidification. 7. Humans also use sand as a construction material, mining huge quantities of it to make concrete. 8. There's such high demand that an illegal worldwide sand market has exploded in recent years. A 2013 estimate valued the shady business at about $16 million a month. 9. India's sand mafia. Yes, it's a thing. is notorious for using violence, bribery, and coercion in the course of illegally collecting and selling the material. 10. More than a legitimate business is at risk. Sand is a finite natural resource which, like fossil fuels, takes centuries to form, and which humans are using at accelerating rates. In 2014, the UN Environmental Program declared that sand mining was causing unequivocal environmental problems. 11. A 2017 study linked the mining to increased coastal erosion, especially devastating in regions prone to tsunamis. Without sandy buffers, the deadly waves are even more destructive, and a retreating tsunami drags sand into the ocean, aggravating the problem. 12. The process of digging up sand can also contaminate groundwater or drive it deeper underground. As a direct result of the practice, farmers in Sri Lanka have difficulty finding clean water to grow crops. 13. When sandy habitats are mined, plant and animal life can get carried away with the haul and invade new areas, crowding out native life. 14. Some nasty species live in sand too, such as parasitic insects called sand fleas. These tiny monsters burrow into a person's skin and stay there for up to 2 weeks, eventually spewing hundreds of eggs. 15. Look closer and you'll see even more life. In 2017, researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Marine Microbiology found whole communities of assorted microbes living on the surface of single grains of sand. 16. Another reason to look at the stuff up close? Sand forensics experts can sometimes tell from the minerals present in a sample, as well as features like grain size, where the sand originated. 17. The investigative subfield is far from perfect, however. A 2016 study found that sand samples collected from rubber-soled shoes revealed only the most recent material the individual walked through. 18. That same year, another team analyzed samples from a scenic spot on the Turkish coast called Cleopatra's Beach. Legend has it Mark Antony shipped barges of sand across the Mediterranean to create it for his queenly consort. The research results? Likely just a legend. 19. In modern times, large quantities of sand do get shipped across sea on a regular basis. Small coastal countries such as Singapore and the United Arab Emirates have imported vast quantities of sand to extend their land out into the ocean via man-made islands. 20. Builder of countries and coral, highly sought and the stuff of legends, sand is out of this world. Really? In 2016, researchers relied on measurements of sand dunes past and present on Mars to better understand the Red Planet's ancient environment. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the Magazine of Science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.